Chapter 1. Stolen, robbed, kidnapped. Of legendary museum thefts, art napping, and the 220-pound gold coin. The disappearance of the Mona Lisa. Museums were built as temples for art, but they must also store their treasures securely. The stories of the big break-ins, raids, and art heists from these temple vaults are the stuff of legend. Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa, for example, first became truly famous after it was stolen from the Louvre in 1911. The theft that time was an inside job. An Italian house painter who had worked in the Louvre as a glazier and therefore knew the security precautions allowed himself to be locked inside the Louvre on a Sunday afternoon, along with two collaborators. The three hid in a small chamber in which copyists usually stored their painting materials and brushes. Monday morning, when the Louvre was closed to visitors, the three men in white coats entered the Salon Carré, simply took the Mona Lisa off the wall, and disappeared through a side exit. In their white coats, they blended in with the employees who cleaned the museum on Mondays. For 2 years, the picture remained missing. The police investigated, and private detectives tried to uncover its whereabouts. Pablo Picasso and Guillaume Apollinaire were suspected and were called in for questioning, but later released. A French newspaper even offered to pay 5,000 francs to a clairvoyant. The Mona Lisa had vanished. For a long time, the person behind the theft remained a mystery. The media believed the story that the thief told. He had stolen the picture for patriotic reasons, to bring it back to Italy where it really belonged. Then, in 1932, the Saturday Evening Post reported that Vincenzo Perugia was, in fact, being directed by someone else. The man who was behind him and who had engaged and paid him and his accomplices, Vincenzo and Michele Lancelotti, was Eduardo de Valfierno, an Argentine by birth. Even today, little is known about their South American employer, who had them address him by the title Marquez. And it's not clear if his story itself is a fake, made up by an American journalist. 2, 3, 6 Mona Lisas. Valfierno, so the story goes, was never really interested in the painting whose theft from the Louvre he had commissioned. What the man behind the biggest art coup of the pre-World War I period wanted wasn't the most famous painting in the world, but the headlines that proved to the world that he could steal it. Born in Argentina, the son of well-to-do parents, he lived off money generated by selling art that he had inherited. At some point, he progressed to commissioning and selling fakes, made-to-order copies of paintings that already existed in private collections. Valfierno, according to Carl Decker's account, commissioned the copies from a restorer named Yves Chaudron and sold them to his clients as stolen originals. The two men supported an entire workshop in Buenos Aires for counterfeit Murillos. The only journalist ever to claim he had interviewed Valfierno was the American Carl Decker of the Saturday Evening Post. The Marquez allegedly told the reporter that because of him, Argentina had more Murillos than cows. I've made this country incredibly richer. Even when his clients realized that they had been deceived, there was little risk for Valfierno. Nobody who has hired someone to steal a work of art would go to the police to complain that the stolen art was fake. And so it went when Valfierno had the most famous painting in the world stolen. Even before the theft, he had already offered the Mona Lisa to several collectors, most of them living in the U.S., and had Chaudron's counterfeits shipped to the U.S. as amateur copies. By the time the headlines appeared about the theft of the Mona Lisa, he had allegedly already sold his various clients, in total, 6 Mona Lisas, which Yves Chaudron had probably begun to paint in the winter of 1910, i.e. before the theft. They were sold, however, as originals, at the hefty price of $300,000 each, about $8 million each in today's valuations. The real Mona Lisa had never left Paris. It stayed with Vincenzo Perugia, about 3 miles from the Louvre. Valfierno enjoyed his riches, traveling to, among other places, North Africa and the Near East. When Carl Decker supposedly met him for their interview in Casablanca, Decker described the Argentine as a big man with a white mane of hair and an elegant white mustache. "Stealing the Mona Lisa," he said, "was so simple, like cooking an egg. Everything was a question of psychology. Our success depended on one thing, the fact that a worker in a white coat was as unsuspicious as an unlaid egg." But the man who had worn that white coat for Valfierno heard nothing further from his employer. He thought first it was an oversight, then a betrayal, and he began at last to craft his own plans. Perugia drove with the painting to Florence, offered it through a gallerist to the director of the Uffizi, and was arrested at the point of transfer on December 12, 1913. In his homeland, he was given a surprisingly light sentence of 1 year and 2 weeks in prison, after a psychiatrist had testified that he was intellectually defective. An appellate judge reduced the sentence to 7 months, which he had already served while awaiting trial. On July 29, 1914, Perugia was again a free man, and he was celebrated as a hero. According to Decker, who is the only source, Eduardo de Valfierno died in 1931 without ever asking for the Mona Lisa, whose theft he had commissioned. The Marquess had adroitly covered his tracks. Perugia didn't even know his real name. Only after the death of the Argentine was Carl Decker allowed to publish his interview. Meanwhile, there remain serious doubts about the veracity of Valfierno's story, for which there is no other source besides Decker. It's uncertain whether Valfierno existed at all. Sawed-off shotguns in the Munch Museum. Nonetheless, even today, the theft of the Mona Lisa is considered the greatest art robbery of all time. That the lowly worker Perugia and his accomplices managed to pull it off made it the criminal version of the Italian David against the French Goliath. But it has very little in common with art criminality today. The three gentle thieves had spied out exactly where they could hide and which paths they had to take to steal the Mona Lisa. They didn't carry any weapons with them, and no one was injured. Double panes of bulletproof glass enclosed the climate-controlled viewing area that now protects the picture, which museum visitors can approach only up to a certain safety zone. Today, art thieves are mostly professional criminals who brutally and recklessly pursue their targets and, according to estimates, cause annual damages in the billions of dollars. The violence with which they go about their business has steadily increased in the past decade and a half. When, for instance, in 2004, a group of unknown culprits stole 2 paintings by Edvard Munch from the Munch Museum in Oslo, they came during regular opening hours. The masked men threatened museum visitors with sawed-off shotguns and risked wounding or even killing them. Many criminals aren't able in the end to unload their valuable goods. Today, through interconnected electronic police databases, to which auction houses, art dealers, and museums all have access, every purchaser of art is able to determine in a very short time whether the work on offer is a clean work or a stolen one that cannot be resold. Today, theft from a museum is rarely about having the work for its own sake. Rather, stolen works of art serve as the basis for extortion from insurers and collectors. Other thieves are interested only in the material from which the objects are made, whether it be the bronze of sculptures or the gold in coins, which can easily be melted down and resold. For as the prices of art have increased rapidly in the past few years, so has the price of precious metals. Art napping. Extortion with art. The brutal attack in February 2008 on the private museum of the Birla Collection Foundation in Zurich, which has since closed, was at the time the biggest art theft ever in Europe. While the museum was open to the public, valuable works by Cézanne, Van Gogh, Monet, and Degas, with an estimated worth of $180 million, were stolen. 4 years later, Cézanne's Boy in a Red Vest was seized in Belgrade. Shortly thereafter, the state prosecutor's office in Zurich let it be known that 1 further painting, Degas' portrait of the Count Lepic with his 2 daughters, had been returned to the collection some months earlier, Whether a reward or extortion money was paid for the return was left unsaid. The clues in another case also led to the Balkans. On a night in October 2012, 7 paintings by Lucien Freud, Gauguin, Meyer de Haan, Matisse, Monet, and Picasso that belonged to the entrepreneurial Cordia family were stolen from the Kunsthal Rotterdam. The case didn't have such a happy ending. The mother of the suspect, Radu D., allegedly burned all the works out of fear her son could be extradited. Except for a few ashes in the oven, there's no proof of her story. Supposedly, there were also attempts in this case to sell the loot back to the owners, though in February, a consortium of insurers had already paid 18.1 million euros for the loss. The business of art napping is lucrative. The secretive millionaire who commissions theft so that he can look at art in his hidden basement doesn't exist, in the opinion of most art investigators. In any case, no such person has been arrested for decades. Not in the two attacks that took place in the final hours of 2009 in southern France, in which 30 valuable artworks by Degas, Picasso, Rousseau, and other classic modernists were stolen, never to be seen again. Not in the theft of 2 Picasso paintings owned by the Sprengel Museum in Hanover, which disappeared from an exhibition in Pfaffikon, Switzerland. Not after Vieron T. in 2010 stole works by Picasso, Braque, and Matisse from the Musée d'Art Moderne de Paris. Not after the disappearance of the Degas pastel, which, in spite of security alarms, unknown persons unscrewed from the wall in the Musée Cantini in the center of Marseille on New Year's Day, 2009. Here, too, the French police assumed it to be an inside job in which museum employees were involved. Similarly, there's been not a trace of the over $100 million worth of treasured paintings by Rembrandt, Vermeer, Degas, and Manet that fake police stole from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston in March 1990, despite a $5 million reward for information offered and the statute of limitations having run out years ago. In the official art market, such world-famous works cannot be sold. And in the digital age, the police at airports, customs officials, and art dealers are all kept well informed through databases of stolen goods. A Goya for the television. One of the earliest cases of art napping caused such a sensation that it made its way into the first James Bond film. On August 21, 1961, a truck driver named Kempton Bunton from Newcastle-upon-Tyne stole a painting by the Spanish artist Francisco de Goya, a portrait of the Duke of Wellington, who would later defeat Napoleon at Waterloo, painted in the summer of 1812 from the National Gallery in London. Bunton, who was 57 at the time, took a ladder and climbed through an open window in the men's bathroom. But he didn't want to extort money. He wanted to strike a blow for social justice. After he turned himself in, he said that he had stolen the artwork in order to establish a fund to pay for the television fees on behalf of needy people. I never intended to keep anything for myself. My only goal was to pay the television license fees for poor and old people who seem to be neglected in our affluent society. He himself watched only private programming, but he was required, as all Britons are, to pay a monthly licensing fee for the publicly funded BBC, which the poor in England generally cannot afford. The painting remained missing for almost 4 years. During this time, the first James Bond arrived in movie theaters. The screenwriters explained the theft in the film by saying that the bad guy had commissioned it. On the screen, millions of filmgoers saw the painting that Scotland Yard had been searching for intensively for months. 64 by 52 centimeters in size, it hung in the stairway in the underground bunker of the villain Dr. No. The case was solved only later. On May 5, 1965, a tall, thin man with wavy blonde hair brought a carefully wrapped package, labeled Glass, Handle with Care, to the luggage storage counter in the New Street train station in Birmingham. He introduced himself as Mr. Bloxham, paid 7 shillings to the person at the counter, Ronald Lawson, and received luggage ticket number F24458, saying, "Be careful with that," he handed over the package. The package, wrapped in cardboard and wood wool, remained for 16 days, jumbled among the luggage on a rack. On May 21st, the editors of the newspaper Daily Mirror received a letter, which, among other things, had the luggage ticket with the number F24458 of the Birmingham train station. Detective Inspector John Morrison and Detective Sergeant Jack Eon rushed there in a patrol car. They rang the attendant out of bed, and at 2 a.m. on May 22nd, they held in their hands the unframed, intact portrait of the Duke of Wellington by Goya. 5 days later, after exhaustive study, the painting was hanging once more next to other paintings by Spanish artists in room 18 of the National Gallery on Trafalgar Square. Kempton Bunton gave himself up to the police and was sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment for the theft of the destroyed frame. It couldn't be proven that he ever wanted to keep the painting. Today, art is stolen by well-organized criminal groups that are staffed by well-educated but poor former soldiers from the Eastern Bloc or the Balkans. Since they've been in the business, said Charles Hill, the former head of the art department of Scotland Yard, it's gotten a lot more brutal. That museums today are attacked during public hours, that visitors are threatened with firearms or a guard is held with a knife at his throat, that didn't used to happen. However easy the theft might be because of bad security precautions, the criminals usually have more trouble transferring or selling the works of art than they do stealing them. To be sure, a gray market for expensive, colorful pictures has existed for many years, especially after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. They're not traded by proper galleries or auction houses, but rather in back rooms, under the counter, or over the internet. Money is laundered in Luxembourg by means of stolen artworks, which are also used to pay for heroin from Turkey and to finance expensive real estate. Even in the classified advertising of respectable publications, such as the Süddeutsche Zeitung, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Welt, or Handelsblatt, works of dubious origin are offered for sale, works that cannot be disposed of in the legal art market. As a rule, this marketing approach is much too public for someone trying to sell stolen pictures. That's why the valuable loot frequently changes hands as payment in illegal businesses, or is eventually offered back to their original owners for extortion money, or simply in exchange for immunity from prosecution. It's not the norm, said a leading figure in one of the largest insurance concerns in the Rhineland on the condition of confidentiality. But you would be surprised how often these deals are made. We would rather pay a small percentage as a finder's fee than the full market value for which the work is insured by us. Shade and darkness in the red light district. Of course, we were under a lot of pressure from Scotland Yard, recalled Charles Hill, who was a police officer at the time. On the evening of July 28, 1994, unknown persons stole two valuable paintings by J.M.W. Turner and one by Caspar David Friedrich from the exhibition Goethe and Art at the Schirn Kunsthalle Frankfurt. Officially, the Frankfurt police were conducting the investigation into this art theft, one of the most spectacular in Germany. But because the Turner paintings were from the Tate Gallery in London, Hill's department was immediately activated as well. I asked the chief superintendent of the Belgravia police station to loan us Jurek Rokoszynski, Hill recalled 10 years later. He spoke German, and the Tate Gallery was in the Belgravia police precinct. The chief superintendent agreed, and my bosses at Scotland Yard too. So Rocky took over and stayed with it, as he and Mickey Lawrence left the police and became independent. The theft, which happened right in downtown Frankfurt, between the landmark medieval Römer, or town hall of Frankfurt, and the cathedral, made headlines worldwide. The last watchman went to turn out the lights in the Schirn Kunsthalle on a warm summer night. All the visitors had left by the time the exhibition halls closed at 10 p.m., and the 14 guards and cashiers had gone home. A lone 28-year-old watchman took his final turn through the museum. As he locked up the exhibition rooms and went to activate the alarm system, two masked men, who had evidently remained hidden somewhere in the exhibition areas, overpowered him. They pulled a cloth hood over his head and held it in place with tape. Then they handcuffed him, took his keys, and put him in a storage room. Seconds later, they unscrewed three paintings from the wall on the upper floor of the exhibition. They climbed into the freight elevator with the three paintings, which were insured altogether for about 62 million Deutschmarks, and left through a back exit on the cathedral side. A driver was waiting there. A married couple walking by saw them load the pictures into a small truck. Since this activity seemed strange to them, they wanted to alert the police, but they were prevented by a long line at the only public telephone in the area. The three burglars were quickly caught. They had left a fingerprint on a door at the scene of the crime, which led the police to the red light district behind the Frankfurt train station. The pictures remained missing for a long time. 2 78 by 78 centimeter oil paintings by Turner, Shade and Darkness, The Evening of the Deluge, and Light and Color, The Morning After the Deluge. In a furious swirl of color, the two pictures, which are among Turner's last works, mark the transition from objective painting to non-objective painting, and the representation of pure light. Similarly, the painting Nebelschwaden, Clouds of Fog, by Caspar David Friedrich, which had been loaned for the Frankfurt exhibition from the Hamburger Kunsthalle, disappeared without a trace. A Polaroid for £1 million. After the theft, several supposed middlemen spoke up and claimed that they had access to the pictures. For example, one Mr. Rothstein, who was later revealed to be a criminal from Nigeria, or two men from Essen, who wanted to sell two blatant forgeries in Antwerp to the Dutch private detective Ben Zodema, who was acting undercover. Again and again, the two museums had their hopes raised, and again, they were disappointed. The big surprise arrived only years later. In December 2002, 8 years after the burglary, the Tate announced that the two Turners had been returned, the one picture only a day earlier, the other already in July 2000. Later in a book about the case, Sandy Nairn, at the time the programming director at the Tate, recalled the futility of the investigation immediately after the crime, and waiting in hotel lobbies in Bad Homburg, near Frankfurt, and in restaurants in Rüdesheim on Rhine. And he remembered the 22nd of February 1999, when it appeared for the first time that they would be able to contact the men who still possessed the pictures years after the crime. The former police officers, Rokoshinsky and Lawrence, learned from a prisoner, who is known to this day only as D, that the Frankfurt attorney and notary, Edgar Liebrooks, could possibly initiate such contact. An informant of ours succeeded in getting access to the crime ring that had stolen the pictures originally. When there was talk about returning the pictures, Liebrooks' name kept coming up because he had represented the culprits in the past. The informant negotiated a meeting between Liebrooks and Jurek Rokoshinsky. One result of this meeting was that he agreed to work with them. Protected by the highest British court, various authorities, and the Frankfurt state attorney, the Tate opened a special account at the Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt. Of the total sum of £24 million that the insurer of the Schirn had had to send to the Tate, £10 million was parked in the account. It allegedly cost £1 million as a security deposit just to persuade the men behind the art theft to produce a Polaroid proving their access to one of the Turner paintings. After numerous frustrating cancellations, delays, and ever-changing conditions, £4 million more flowed to the thieves. Until finally, on July 19, 2000, Shade and Darkness was turned over in Frankfurt. All the participants, including Sandy Nairn, insist to this day that the money wasn't to pay off an extortion demand, but as compensation for information leading to the recovery of valuable pictures. To avoid endangering the negotiations for the second Turner, the participants agreed to keep quiet about the return of the first painting. Only 2 of the 12 members on the museum's board were told. Edgar Liebrooks did not want to comment on whether the people handling the return of the painting were the people who stole it in 1994. I have nothing at all to say about that. It took almost another 2.5 years until Light and Shade was turned over to Sandy Nairn and his colleague Roy Perry at the Frankfurt office of the attorney. Several earlier dates for the handover had failed, Nairn said, recalling the Battle of Nurs. Edgar Leebrooks once stated elsewhere that he had been picked up at his office in autumn 2002 and driven to a hut in the forest. There the two Turners and the Kaspar David Friedrich were shown to me. After exhaustive examination, the picture was also turned over to representatives of the Tate Gallery on December 14, 2002, and once again £5 million in cash was paid. A few years ago, Leebrooks explained, I put the money in a plastic bag in the Frankfurt Zeil, gave it to those from whom the painting came, referring to a street in the downtown retail district. In his book about the case, Sandy Nairn described the robbery of the Schirn as a story from the abysses of the museum world. To rescue valuable cultural goods, should one work with the criminals who probably belong to the Serbian mafia and possibly have blood on their hands? Do the means justify the ends in this instance? Nairn concludes that this question can be answered only on a case-by-case basis. He was glad that the highest authorities in his country had expressly approved the approach he took. That the operation would in the end be a net plus for the Tate was something that he could not foresee at the time. A year after the theft, in April 1995, the responsible insurance company, Hiscox, transferred the insured amount of £24 million. 3 years later, the Tate acquired, with the agreement of the Finance and Cultural Ministries, ownership of both paintings at a cost of £8 million, should they ever surface again. The transaction was risky, since at the time nobody seriously thought that a return was in the cards. When, however, it came to pass, the museum could rejoice not only about the valuable paintings, but also because it was now £16 million richer.